Ed, thank you for coming.
No problem, Ed. It's quite a pleasure.
Quite. Look, we've got ourselves a problem on our hands.
Bill collectors?
No, Ed, it's this Bat Segundo guy.
You mean the guy who does the intros?
Yes, he's getting a bit grating, don't you think?
Well, it's a formula.
But he just doesn't fit the part. I mean, these are serious interviews we're doing.
Yes.
And there's been some speculation that these intros are killing the show.
Well, you can't please everybody.
It's not a matter of pleasing everybody, it's a question of casting.
Oh, you mean like Mimi Weddle? She's 92 and nobody's stopping her.
You know, Ed, that we don't have that kind of talent, or at least we don't want others to know precisely what our talent is. We don't even want to be aware of what we're good at, except this idea that we're supposed to be serious interviewers. Apparently.
Is this your way of suggesting a shift to an NPR kind of program?
Not as long as we're carrying on a conversation with ourselves.
Christ, Ed, you're really an egomaniac.
Okay, so I am here with Mimi Weddle, as well as Jill Johnstone, who are behind the film Hats Off. Mimi and Jill, how are you doing?
Well, we're doing great.
I think so. Very happy to be here.
Okay. Well, first off, I had a question for Jill concerning the bookends of this film. You start in Central Park, and you end in Central Park. In the very beginning, we see slow-motion shots of joggers, cyclists, and the like, and then at the end of the film, we see Mimi going off in a pedicab. So I wanted to ask you about this, setting this in New York. Was this really the only place in New York that you can have something in which there is no change, because Central Park has pretty much remain more or less the same compared to the rapid changes in Manhattan and Brooklyn? Maybe you can talk about this great carriage exit of Mimi at the end.
Well, I started out because it was the beginning of the day, and I just thought it made sense to start in the park because the park is a very quiet place, especially in the morning, and then people start coming, there's the jogging, then the city wakes up. So I started there, and also because I found it very romantic. Then we go to the end of the film with Mimi in the little pedicab. I really wanted to end it, as you said, you're the first person that's even mentioned the fact that there are bookends, because I thought it would be really nice to have her walk through the park, and I don't even know if we should talk about the ending.
Oh, well.
It's so nice, but yeah.
we didn't entirely reveal it. So.
Yes, we really wanted to do a bookend like that because it is very romantic. And there are lots of places in New York, but that's the one that we chose. And I think it really worked out well. Though I have to say, right before that scene, Mimi was in Florence.
Yes.
And many, many people said to me, why? Why did you not finish the film in Florence? It would have been so complete. And I said, because Mimi is from New York, and she works in New York, and you have to get her back into New York, otherwise they'll think she died in Florence.
Well, how much time, Mimi, are you now spending in Florence these days? You say in the film that you plan to die there, so...
Oh, I really have thought that for a very long time, probably from the time I was about 15. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing thing, but it keeps coming back to me. However, I can't say enough about the beginning of Jill's film, Hats Off. I can't tell you how the tears come every time. I've seen it several times.
Yeah.
But the tears come to my eyes every time she panders across the camera, goes across the scene of New York. You notice there's a mood that comes at that point with the lighting, the height of the buildings, which doesn't absolutely overwhelm you. You're just, it's the mood I wish could be threaded all over New York.
Yeah.
In actuality, because it has a sensitivity to it that you don't feel in New York most of the time.
Well, there's also this troubling conundrum here, because you state many times throughout the film that you never set out to be a star, and yet, inarguably, you are the star of this particular film. How do you feel about this particular development? And also, seeing yourself on screen like this has got to be a very intriguing self-Rorschach test.
Oh, mercy, mercy. You know, I keep saying it. Handsome is as handsome does. I mostly think of the people in the background who are shooting this. Jill Wood was absolutely a genius at the last moment, finding a group, a photographer, a background, or a lighter, or somebody like that. At the last moment, she'd find them. And so therefore, it was painless. That kind of thing, to me, was just painless. So I feel that I feel it's everybody's effort that made this image come on the screen. And it couldn't have been done without everybody, the producers and Jill and her genius for the right touch, the right moment. Very well done. And being a friend of my daughters, I must say, I'm very proud of them both.
Yeah. Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about, Jill, this notion of, you have subjects in this who are in show business. You have choreographers, casting directors, and the like, but you also have members of Mimi's family. So you're dealing with two sets of people, one who are used to having a camera in front of them and act as if it's invisible, and another who may not have that particular camera in front of them. So what steps did you take to traverse these two sets of people? Because there's clearly got to be some sort of disparity based off of these, this whole scenario here.
Well, I think with Mimi's family, because they knew me, I think there was a built-in trust, which may or may not have been the best thing. but I really felt that plus they're very easygoing people. And so they opened up and they really said what came from their heart, and they didn't seem to act any different than when I am one-on-one and with them without the camera. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's pretty extraordinary, actually, how they acted, because they were just so open with the camera.
But if it was not the best thing, do you think that this may have caused some problems in presenting the entire truth? Do you think that they were capable of operating in a truly candid, honest manner in front of you, or were there, I mean, what do you mean by that?
I think sometimes maybe they were perhaps too candid, and it wouldn't have been suitable for the film, or it was extremely suitable for the film. It just depended. You know, I didn't get to interview a lot with Tommy.
Yeah.
We only did, I think, two scenes with him, but at two different times in his life.
Yeah.
Earlier and then later on. And he has yet to see the film.
Really?
So I'm rather curious about that. He's going to see it, I think, Saturday with his daughter, Anna.
Why was Tommy reticent to participate in the film? Did he just not want to be part of this show business scenario? Or maybe you could talk about your relationship to Tommy, who I know you take to task at one point for being too rotund.
Yes, he always resents my saying that, but I say it just the same. I don't apologize to him for saying that, because I feel it's his health that's important. But then, Tommy and I really get along very well if he's talking on the telephone to me, which is quite often. One-on-one, we could very quickly arrive at an argument. Mm. And he's difficult to understand because of his deep, deep sensitivity, which was created when he was very young. I don't know how that happened, but he is also his own self. I'm not going to do a psychological portrait of Tommy, for one thing. I don't understand him. I'll never understand him.
Well, did Jill, he express reticence to be part of the film? Or?
No, he never did. He was always very gung-ho about it. But, you know, people don't realize that maybe one day this is really actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And that could be part of it, too. But no, he had no qualms about doing it at all. He went for it.
While we're on the subject of Tommy, I actually wanted to ask you about the photographs in your apartment, Mimi. You have Dick up there, and you point out that he didn't approve of this particular photograph, and there you are judging, as we established, Tommy for being less rotund in that particular moment.
Yes.
But I wanted to ask you, because this is interesting to me, because you're also committed to visiting Elizabeth Arden's 3 times a week. And I'm wondering if you march so steadfastly to your own drumbeat, as is very clear by this film, why can't Tommy march to his drumbeat, even if it is just as a financial services consultant, as we have the American Graffiti moment at the close, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think it's because Tommy was born a genius. I really think that. I was told when he was in kindergarten, Mimi, pediatrician, said, please send him to this special school in Philadelphia. He is just too bright. You must send him where they can observe him with about 4 other children in this place. And I said, absolutely not. That's ridiculous. If he's just overly bright, fine. He can find a way to work with in a regular school. Mm-hmm. I didn't. And so I didn't do that. I've often wondered whether or not many of his troubles came from that, actually. Because he's sweet as pie. Yeah. I mean, he's just the sweetest creature. Well, if he has anything, it's yours, if you would like it. He's the most open, generous, and his heart is on his sleeve. He's interesting in a way, and yet if you were at a party with him, it would be a surprise if you would be able to get one word from that man, because he's shy.
Yeah, but people can be shy, and in fact this notion of rotundity that we're bringing up here, this runs counter to your own great desire to remain thin, that is expressed in this film. So I'm wondering again, why can't he march to his own drumbeat? I know inevitably, if you're a parent, there are disappointments sometimes, or you're not necessarily happy with the way that some kids grow up. But, you know, I mean, at the same time, it's the same sort of spirit that you have in this, of proceeding forward and going ahead and saying, you know, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to go become a full-time actor at the age of 65. So, you know, maybe he has a late start ahead of him. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, I never make up my mind to do one thing or another. Yeah. It just happens. Life is a kind of a series of events, and they just God means for them to happen, and it just happens. It's a very light, the incredible lightness of being.
Yeah.
It's kind of that thing in my house, and that's the way it was rather unconventional, and conventional, I know, but that's the way the whole family was, including my husband and Sarah and Tommy. It was very light-hearted and humorous. It was fun, and it was musical. So in that way, Tommy and I are very close.
Mm-hmm. Got you. Well, Jill, this is not your first film depicting an older individual. You've made a few other documentaries. Your last one was Throwing Curves, which chronicled 97-year-old industrial designer Evel Zeisel.
Zeisel.
My apologies. And you also have Martha and Ethel depicting 2 octogenarian nannies that you grew up with. I'm wondering why this concern on your part for people who are older, why this prism? Did you sort of stake out this documentary territory just in the same way that Mimi managed to kind of have a corner on the market with her particular roles of older ladies? Or
gosh, I don't think so. You know, I think I grew up without older people in my life. My grandmother, I'd only had one grandmother, and she died when I was 5. And there was this whole thing about aging. And I think I was always sort of afraid of older people and did not really hang out with them or anything. And I think as I myself got older, I got more interested in older people. And the first film that I did was Martha and Ethel, was actually a very personal documentary about my nanny, who happened to be 85 at the time. But it started out, you know, it's a whole story of her life. But I wasn't old enough until I got to be in my 30s to understand the importance of a Martha in my life, because she did take over the role of my mother in a lot of ways. You know, I think I'm fascinated with older people because I'm a bit afraid of getting old myself, and I'm looking for role models.
But on the extraordinary end of post-80, that's what makes this kind of an interesting niche for you, you know?
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting thing. I mean, I feel that older people need more respect.
Yeah.
And I spent a couple of years in Italy. I was very lucky to live in Bologna, Italy, where the older people are really part of society. But in New York City, in major cities, they're not part of the society. They're put away. And I don't think that's fair, and I don't want to be put away when I'm in my 80s and 90s. And I think I make films that celebrate getting older, because in society, we never, ever celebrate our elders.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I agree with you. Well, Mimi, at one point in the film on this subject, you say the older you get, the less you dwell on anything miserable that has happened. If you do, you're done for. And yet there's one moment late in the film in which you cried. In fact, you just described this notion of seeing the film and crying. And on the morning that Dick dies, you send your daughter Sarah off to Elizabeth Arden's. Mm-hmm. And you yourself go off to an audition in California. So maybe this is a question for both of you. I mean, what degree can one dwell upon misery or grief? Or is it a matter of continuing to move forward? I mean, is this film an effort to answer the question of just how much one can rise above it? So that mm-hmm. mantra reads in your particular apartment, mm-hmm. Maybe? Or mm-hmm. what's the deal?
Well, I was on my way to Dick's service at St. Thomas. Mm-hmm. And the place was really filled. It was amazing. He was a very popular man. In any case, here I came down in the elevator and they told me that this call was from California. And it was Michael Ritchie, I think it was Ritchie, who called and said, "Can you audition this afternoon?" And I said, "Sure, I'm on my way to Dick's funeral, but I will certainly audition." What else? I mean, people have been rather astonished that I would do that on the way to Dick's service, but what else was there for me to do? Just go home and worry about the bills? No. In any case, I did the audition, and they wanted me to come to Texas to shoot the film. I said, fine, and so off I went.
Yeah. But I mean, certainly,
to me, it's not a surprise. Yeah. It's just natural.
Sure.
You have choices in life, you know? You either look forward, look back, have regrets or not have regrets. I mean, I think the reason why I'm attracted to Mimi is that she lives in the moment. You know, she is living in this world, in this city, at this moment. And that's very special. And I think that's something that we should applaud.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's living in the moment, and there's also stopping, at least for a beat, to take in a serious piece of information. You know what I mean?
And look at the stars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. But just looking at the stars, dear, and having illusions of, you can live in the moment, but part of your head is up there. And because one always knows that there's a certain something. Everybody has their own way of expressing it. But I know everybody is made of two people. And part of them is elsewhere than what they're involved in. I am so sure of this, but nobody seems to admit it. That's one thing about growing old that I don't like at all. And it's one reason why I take that little teaspoon of brandy, because it brings my head back into a position where I can really think more clearly and have more energy. Mm. I really think that that is, providing you don't take the whole bottle, for heaven's sakes. But one would assume you wouldn't if you have a job to do.
Yeah.
But it really helps. But I miss that God-given energy, mm-hmm. without the little teaspoon of brandy.
Yeah. There's one question I had in relation to this film. I mean, acting, as we all know, is a really physical-oriented business in which you have casting directors and directors in general really judge people based off of their looks. And here you are, Mimi, 93. Essentially, you have two strikes against you in a business that regrettably casts people because of gender, that is sexist sometimes and is ageist sometimes. But I'm wondering, you say that you will pretty much take on almost every role, and I'm wondering if there are any particular limits to this, or if you've been asked to do something that just didn't fit the kind of performance quality that you want to bring, or the quality that you want to bring to a performance, and why this particular question, which is brought up in the film, I mean, if there were any specific incidents that you've experienced of dealing with this real notion of being an actor. I mean, it goes well beyond just 14-hour cattle calls. It's also this notion of being judged, I don't like you, you look this way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I do not like the Dr. Fell, yes, I know. Or you're not the type.
Yeah, yeah.
Or what about just recently? You were on that TV show with the hermaphrodite?
Oh, no. We won't talk about that.
Right. Well, do please do.
That was in the back room.
No, that was in the back room.
Yes, and that was in the dressing room part of it. He wasn't part of the show in that respect, in any case. Now I've lost my thought.
Well, the thought being, have you encountered any specific unreasonable requests that have not been pursued in this film?
One of my first commercials, I think it was the first, it was done up in the Catskills. I was so happy to have this because I was very, very poor. I needed that. Dick had died, yes. So here I am in the Catskills, and the first thing they did was hand me a bicycle, ride around here. I knew I could do the gymnastic thing that they were going to ask for, because they'd warned me of that, but I didn't count on the bicycle. I do not know how to ride a bicycle. I cannot learn how. It's because evidently I'm built lopsided or something. I cannot stay on a bicycle. The other thing that was so surprising, the director couldn't believe it. Nobody could believe that I couldn't ride a bicycle. working with what? It was a big Hollywood director. And he said, Mimi, just get in this. It was an old automobile. He showed me. He said, just get into this old hack and drive. I said, are you mad? I don't know how to drive, let alone. I said, furthermore, I'm scared to death. I know this sounds ridiculous, but I am literally afraid of a machine. And that starts with the typewriter. It starts with the telephone. I can't bear to talk on the telephone, but I adore the radio.
Yeah.
It's the one machine I love. I know in the film, Hats Off, by golly, I think it was the student bodies in that little three-legged garbage thing, container, and that was taking my life in my hands. It really was, but I didn't think anything about it. I thought it looked like such a great idea. That's it.
Well, here you have the telephone, and you must answer the telephone because, who knows, it could be a casting, it could be a gig.
Oh, I take those, don't worry, I take those things as fast as I possibly can. And if it's possible, I will say, I'll write a letter to you, and I do.
Now, there are a number of film and television clips of Mimi's performances, and I'm wondering if, Jill, you had any problems trying to obtain some of these. I mean, it was a pretty impressive collection, but that couldn't have been easy to haggle over with various producers and rights and all that.
Well, actually, we found this fantastic lawyer named Michael Donaldson, who pioneered fair use.
Yeah.
Which basically, because Mimi was in all of these clips, we were entitled to use it without a cost.
Huh. Interesting.
Hooray. because otherwise we couldn't have used all of that.
Wow, because some of the clips go on for about more than a minute, I think, you know? So if based off of this being a document, that's really fascinating.
It's a whole new area.
Yeah.
And it is fantastic, and we're very lucky that we got onto him.
Wow. And that also saved production costs.
Huge. Yeah.
I wanted to ask Mimi, here you are having one habit of smoking a cigarette versus not abstaining in another habit of swearing. I wanted to ask you about that, why one habit is better than the other, or why one is worse than the other.
They're both the same, I guess. I'm looking rather at that ashtray over there, and I'm wondering where my... I usually take a cigarette and cut it in half, and break it in half. And that happened, that habit started during World War II, when there weren't many cigarettes, so one would let it go on as long as possible, and that's where my cigarette holder came into view, because that you could smoke down to the very end. I swear, yes, if I'm getting ready for an audition and I can't find my glasses, I can't find my special lipstick or something like that, well, I do swear, and it's great. Or I scream. Just scream. But, I mean, I'm not screaming at anybody, just life in general, that it's too much. I think my grandmother would die on her, faint, dead away at some of the things I say, because I can't find my lipstick. It's the pressure of being on time. I was taught, without any quibbling, be on time. Mm-hmm. You are causing that other person to disrupt their lives if you're not. I was left standing at the Schubert Theater in Boston on Tremont Street. I will never forget it.
Wow.
By an aunt who had invited me to the theater, and I was late on a matinee.
I wanted to ask Jill a question. You shot this documentary over the course of 10 years, but you were putting the finishing touches on Throwing Curves. I'm wondering if you need to have multiple documentary films going on at the same time, or if you just need to sort of stay busy. I'm seeing a common work ethic here among you two.
You know what happened? I started Mimi when she was 83, and we did a lot of the interviews for the first year or so. And then I read an article in the New York Times about Eva Zeisel, who at the time was 92. And I just thought, well, gosh, she sounds like a fascinating woman. I think I'd like to call her and see if she'd be interested in making a film about her. So since she was 10 years older, I really felt I needed to go with her. So I started filming her, and then every time, because I live in San Francisco, so every time I'd come to the city, I'd do mostly Eva and a little bit of Mimi, depending on if Mimi had anything going on.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So that's how that worked.
Okay. There's one thing I wanted to ask you about. Near the end of the film, Mimi, you quote a poem. It includes the lines, "He is all alone standing on the stage surrounded by silence. There is nothing so quiet as the empty theater." Now, I was really curious about this. I went through my noggin and I couldn't dig up the poem. I dug through Norton anthologies. What was the name of this particular poem?
The name... it's a very famous one.
Yeah.
I
tried Google results. I mean, I just couldn't dig
mercy.
It up.
You know, that's in my mind very often.
Yeah.
That sitting on the stage, because I have done that, sat at the end of a show, being so exhausted, sitting on the stage. Mostly that particular thing that I'm thinking about right now is exhaustion from having designed the stage setting, done the lighting, advised on the clothes, done the choreography, and so forth. Just too much for one person. And I was apt to do that in the old days. And then sit down on the stage when nobody's there and cry. Now, his name is something that is written in the stars, dear, and it has left my mind. You see what happens?
Yeah.
I will certainly see that you get that.
Yeah, okay,
it's
sure.
One of the most famous stage poems ever.
Yeah, and I'm blanking
too.
Yeah,
it's gone.
We're going to have to do our best to excavate this.
I'll send it to you by satellite.
Gotcha.
Would Sarah know it?
No, she wouldn't know
it. Do you know, Jill, what this poem is?
No.
Nobody knows. I mean, I kept thinking to myself that I was wondering if it was a poem that you may have heard or that has been circulated among the stage. And just
Rarely do theater people know that poem.
Yeah.
But one of my coaches who's coming to the show on Friday, I've gone over that with him because there are... It's a fairly long poem, and as you get down at the end, you get more and more on the dark side of life and the sadness that comes with an empty stage.
Yeah,
gotcha. And the lights have gone. You know that feeling if you're...
I do. I did a little bit of acting. Well, there's one last question I wanted to ask you about. I observed something very interesting in this film, where Mimi refers to her parents as mother and father, and her kids refer to her as Mimi. So something got lost in the generational shift in which mom or dad or even mother and father, what happened here? Maybe both of you could talk about this. I found that quite an interesting, I'm fascinated by how people refer to each other.
Very odd, isn't it,
It
Jill?
Is, because I remember Sarah always saying, talking about Mimi. I said, who's Mimi? My mother. You know, that's what she called you, was Mimi and Dick. But why?
I don't know. So many people have asked me that. You know, it's a ridiculous thing to say. You don't know, but I don't know why.
Did they ever refer to you as mother or mom? Or?
I think two outside people... If they, well, I have to ask, no, that's my grandson. He will always say, well, I have to ask mother first.
Yeah.
But I don't think my children ever said, I have to ask mother first. No, I don't think they ever did. Why is that? I don't know. I really don't.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Jill, Mimi, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out. It was great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was great.
Look up from the hymnal around at the faces of families closing their eyes. We're taking communion and bearing.